How do you scale a business to 7 figures? Then how do you scale to 8 figures? Then how do you scale to 9 figures? If you've ever wanted to know what it takes to grow a business, then you're in the right place. Thanks for tuning in to Scaling with Samir. This show is intended to celebrate and highlight techniques and strategies taught by today's leaders in the business world. Want to know how an e-commerce business started in someone's home to being the world's largest sock store? Want to learn what it takes to become the CEO of one of the largest global online marketplaces? How about actionable steps to building stronger relationships with your customers to produce more revenue? Do you know which numbers you should be paying attention to and which numbers will lead you to success? How will you make your marketing campaigns successful after cookies are gone? Want to learn from the leaders in brand building and attention-grabbing marketing? Well, all of those are already in our previous listed episodes, and this episode will be no exception. I interview the top marketers that are influencing the market, making an impact, scaling faster than their competitors, and doing good for the world. We will dissect what they did to get to the multi-million dollar mark. I'm your host, Samir Al-Kamouni, founder and CEO of Fetch & Funnel, which is a performance marketing agency specializing in scaling businesses. Sign up to receive tactics to apply directly to your business to improve results and scale at fetchfunnel.com/podcast. At the end of each episode, my goal is to have you feeling inspired and fired up by learning from today's top innovators, marketers, and entrepreneurs. Let's dig into another amazing story about a unique business crushing it and learn from their success and learnings. Hello there, and welcome to the Scaling with Samir podcast. I'm your host, Samir Al-Kamouni, and today I'm super excited to be featuring not only an innovative brand who's been around for quite some time that is done a great job of establishing a foothold in a very competitive industry, but also a brand that has, let's say, stood up the test of time through different economies and fashion trends, you name it. And so I'm very excited to be speaking with Jack, who is the founder of Jack Georges. Jack, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, hello.
I would love have our listeners who might not be familiar with Jack Georges, can you tell us a bit about the story, maybe behind the brand and what makes your leather goods so special?
Well, you know, I had a mentor start with us as a company in 1981. So in 87, when I resigned from my company, he was a mentor to me, and I told him that I want to start my own company. So he said, Jack, call the name Jack Georges, your name. Trust me, I'm older than your dad. Putting the company in your name, the retailer will respect you. Also, it will guard you against doing no mistake because your name is on it. So again, this was a very, very, I was fearful at the moment, using, as I said, a name personally, going into business, not sure exactly where things are going to turn around. But again, that was my mentor, and I thought that was a good advice. God bless his soul. He had passed away like 20 years ago. But again, he was a very instant mentor into using my name as a company, as a brand.
I love it. And you know, I'd love for you to tell maybe a little bit about more about the brand, who people who, you know, haven't heard of it, and yeah, anything that really makes you unique.
Well, again, what made us unique, we stood behind what we made. We made a product here in the U.S. Personally, I came to the country when I was age 18, so I had to work on a bench, pay my dues. I worked for $2.50 an hour. I became the first supervisor at age 20, production manager, purchasing manager, and then went to sales and marketing. So knowing all that part, it's really created for me an opportunity to start. I was able to make my own design, my own samples, able to go to the stores as a salesperson, getting feedback from the customer. That really gave me some advantage over my competition. If they were larger, they were sitting in their offices, get report. I was on the forefront. I was not afraid of working. I have to say, I put 80 hours plus work in the beginning. Went to see a customers in the morning, and I came back to the shop in the middle of the day, changed my shirt, my tie, sit down on a sewing machine, produce. So when I went out, I felt important as a higher end price. I went into the market as a premium price point, not a lower price point. So you have to be fit in that level also to be able to be in Madison Avenue or in Neiman Marcus or any upper retailer. You have to go in with the idea that you are, you know, well established, or at least new. So you sold them exclusivity, you sold them uniqueness. I couldn't sell them because I'm the best. I just came into the market. So I couldn't be the best producer or the best brand, but I didn't want to be the cheapest also, but I had to be something different. And that was unique, personal, on touch with my customers. So, okay.
Well, 1987 was a tough year to start a business, especially in manufacturing. What motivated you to take that leap and launch Jack George's during kind of that economic downturn?
Well, again, there was a couple of circumstances. One, I decided to resign from my job, and I was a sales manager at the time. And also, I was coincided with I was engaged, so I broke, you know, we broke up the engagement. And that was a crucial moment. I was free of personal commitment, allowing me to pursue my dream without the burden of mortgage, family, responsibility. And that was, you know, cemental. Free to work 80 hours plus. I didn't have to come home and said, where were you? You know, I mean, those are the things that I felt there was an advantage that I had to take on. And so I would say that was really the 87. As I said, the opportunity came in with panicking. There was a tough time, but then was a good opportunity to start as well, you know?
Yeah, I love that. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, it's some of those businesses out of economic downturns have been some of the most successful ones.
Yeah, that's right? Absolutely. I mean, that's what I would, yes.
And then you mentioned starting with a small team of skilled craftsmen. How did you find and recruit those who shared your vision?
That was a little bit easy when I decided to resign. The company itself I was working with, they had decided to close their shop in New York. I mean, they had moved the business from New York City to Long Island. And that freed me that I was able to recruit some of my best employees that I had hired. I was production manager. I ran 100 people shop. I had the opportunity to bring these people in. So yes, I was able to choose a handful top employees that I had experience with. They trust me. I trust them. And so that was an advantage because the company, as I said, they moved. So a lot of people didn't move with to Long Island.
Now, the leather goods market's very competitive. I'm curious, how have you differentiated Jack George's, you know, from the start and then also, you know, over the years since you've been in business for so long?
Well, again, to succeed, I focus on being a different. So I approach in Dallas, Neiman Marcus, which is I'm in business 6 months. Who are you as a new brand and to go and call on a high-end stores? The company I was working with, we were middle price point, never called in store like Neiman. So here I'm in Dallas, a park, you know, go to Main Avenue, you start a business, you cover up all your expenses. I put a quarter in a machine, I walk into that, you know, at the main office in Main Avenue, and I walk out with an order. I preach the exclusivity, the uniqueness, the newness. So for a store like Neiman, that where they were looking, the quality was great. I was very comfortable with the quality. But the fact that I was, again, exclusive brand to their store, it's a new brand to the market. They were testers. So they gave me that opportunity. So now I open up a Neiman Marcus and Madison Avenue shops or others. I mean, so that means I had the quality to stand behind what I said and also the quality to be able to. So for some stores, I was approaching them as unique and different and exclusive. And the others were, you know, I treat the people the way retailer how they treat me too.
No, makes sense. I'm curious, you were so boots on the ground then, right? Is you're talking about meeting with customers, going to Neiman Marcus, doing all right, you're selling, you're sewing, you're doing all the things, right?
Yeah.
It's so different, you know, people think about in this day and age, it becomes different, right? Is it so many people are of course trying to do things more digitally, right? Here we are on this podcast together, right? On separate from each other, you know, in different locations. I'm curious if did that, you know, boots on the ground Do you think that gave you a, you know, we know it gave you a competitive edge, right? At that time and led to so much of your success. Okay. But if you were starting it again today, almost knowing what you know now, would you take a similar approach to the business? Would you still, you know, really do a lot of that, you know, knocking on doors and show, you know, working at it that way?
I would say so if you can. I mean, yes, could be a little bit more challenging because, as I said, the market was open, wide open. You could have walked into any doors and you have a store. And also stores were healthier. Business could have been better today. If you call on an account, two problem issue. One, they're going to be able to pay your bills, their bills if you sell them. You're going to be able to give them a credit. Are you, you know them enough to know something about them? And this is, I think, this is that really the challenge of whether you are a marketer or not, is knowing your customers. I made always sure that whenever stores I went to, I knew a little bit about them. I studied their business, their home, their wealth payment, if they pay there on time or not. I mean, those are important to me. You know, I pay my bills always on time. I don't worry about it because it's very important for me. I don't want to do business with anybody who doesn't know how to make money. I don't believe that you could work with people who lose money. Eventually, it's going to come back and hit you. So I make sure all my suppliers today, or whoever I work with, they have to be comfortable. You know, what make people, you know, rich and poor? Is it how much money you have in a bank? It's not true. If you already cover up your expenses and you leave behind your mean and you have more than you spend, you know, you're a rich person. Doesn't matter. I thought I was rich when I made $3 an hour. And I thought I was rich when I was 10 times more than that. So personality, when it's come to rich, is really how do you define richness? To me, stay within your mean, you know, pay your bills on time, have integrity in your way of doing business. And I think those are the area that I felt made me different. So if today is different, you know, I would call it similar. I have a niece who just came from France and they open up a pastry shop and they're doing phenomenal. You know, again, in a market like this, it's flooded with so many different competition. They are very focused to what they're doing. So they are very successful, you know. To be in leather business is any different? Again, yes, manufacturing could be a little bit more challenging now to start. But then again, if you are going to buy, let's say, investing in a machine, you may be able to get a machine today at 80% off because there's so much out there. I think it's more about is how many hours you want to put, willing to put in the beginning and cover up your, you know, keep your expense within line. You could make it today, tomorrow, or any day. I don't think there's a different challenge, but definitely I think could be done anytime.
And you also brought up something earlier as well, where that's, you were always paying attention to your customers and how they felt about the product as well. I mean, I'm curious, what role has that customer feedback played in the evolution of your products?
I'm sorry.
Just getting like that customer feedback, right? And interacting with your customers. Yeah. How has that influenced either new products or existing products?
Well, again, visiting the customers was two things. You go into a stores and the store's telling you that, Jack, this is just came in. So when you see your competition firsthand, you have to be up front. You have to be in those doors. They also have access to them telling you what their consumers are asking for. So here you come back to your shop. You know how to make product. You know what they're asking for. Whether it's a color, it's a new color that is coming in strong, if it's a new trend, you're able to produce something, make the proto samples. I made a proto sample. I use that proto sample to know if there's something go wrong with it or not for a day or two. So within a very short time, I was able to come to the market with a new product, you know, with a product that they were asking. And that was a different than a larger competition who have a more advantage than you in marketing and whatever. But for them, till they receive those information, could have taken 6 months. I was in already within a week or two. I was already back in the market with a new product.
I love it. Which is rare, right? It's rare, and I think a lot of brands sometimes assume that they know best sometimes, and sometimes they do, right? Sometimes they're creating new innovative products and whatnot. But on the other hand, it is so important to be listening to your customer to then take that feedback and like you said, also pay attention to trends and different things.
Absolutely. I'm even till today, this many years in business, I don't need the financial. I'm in the store at least twice or three times a week in different stores, in a different market. You have to see what's going on, to see firsthand, ask questions. You know, look at trends. So I think those are important. You cannot stop, you know, till the day, as long as you're working, that's part of the job. But also being a purchasing manager and a production manager in my history had given me one advantage. And I think a lot of companies fail into that. You know, you have a sales, you have a production manager and you have a purchasing manager. Those two, sometimes they are enemy within each company. Mm. For instance, the purchasing guy will come to his boss and say, "Boss, I save you money. I bought this leather or I bought this material at 40% cheaper or 20% cheaper." When all of a sudden the quality wasn't that great, the effect on the production was. So when those two people are not equally work together, or could be this, in my situation, I was the same person. I was the one who made the product, bought the product and produced it. So at some point or another, I had a little bit more understanding that if I save money on purchasing, I want to be sure that did not affect the production, because this could go both way too.
Yep.
So those are, I think, elements that in any company that they have to be coordinating together. You can't just save on purchasing and cost you more on production or vice versa. So
yeah, no, absolutely. Has there been roadblocks along the way where you know, where maybe you can,
it's okay.
Where, you know, has there been challenges kind of with staying true to the American made craftsmanship?
I think that definitely there was a challenge. The roadblock to me started in first roadblock was 2001 after 9/11, the whole world changed. I found all of a sudden retailers were not paying their bills. Bankruptcy was happening quite a bit. And that to me was, luckily it was already, I was in business for 13, 14 years prior to that. I had built up enough equity in finance. So I was in a positive, and that's really what I turned around, as I said, and I went on buying an investment in a downturn market that I bought it, and I was able to get it as a better price, or, you know, as cheaper prices. So again, that roadblock became growth for me, where my competitive, they were weaker, they fall down, and I was able to achieve a little bit of growth after that back again. So.
Got it. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I like this trend that you're alluding towards, where you're taking certain hard times and using them to your advantage, and using them almost as opportunities to differentiate yourself in the market, to launch into the market, to enter into new business, into new accounts, et cetera.
I mean, my first one, as I said, was 2001. 2008 was the other meltdown, which was a financial meltdown. And all of a sudden I had a major retailer here in Miami and Philadelphia, New Jersey stores that had to file bankruptcy. And I took over those stores, and the guy who hit me with, I wouldn't call the numbers, but they were a lot, big money, big dollars. I hired him as a manager. People said, "How come the guy screw you with whatever?" I said, "Why not? He was a good guy. Just he overexpanded. And he collapsed. So I was able to take over those stores at the airport shops within 24 hours. And it was, the name switched to Jack George. So we took opportunity in 2001 was one opportunity, in 2008 was another. So you always have to be optimistic. You always have to look at what you lost is what you could gain in the same time. But you have to be in that positive mindset that things are going to turn. And eventually they do.
So true. So true. I'm curious, as you know, how did you build such strong relationships with your suppliers, you know, as you know, as you just kind of alluded towards?
Okay. You mean, okay.
Like, was there, yeah. No, no, it was just, was there anything, you know, I think of a lot of our startups, right? A lot of the startups we work with and a lot of the businesses that we work with that are growing, right? And sometimes scaling production process sort of while maintaining that high quality standards is tough, right? And then also when people are starting out and they're trying to work with manufacturers, right? And they want to build those relationships with those suppliers and manufacturers, but they're not, you know, they're not a huge player. They're not buying huge amounts of fabric or leather or whatever it is that they're doing. And I'm just curious, did you have any tips on either, right? On either, yeah, either kind of scaling that production process and still kind of maintaining the high quality of standards, but also, you know, building those strong relationships with your suppliers.
Well, it's essential to visit your supplier and build up a relationship, no question about it. And you want to be sure that they are reliable and they are profitable. People said, what do you care if they're profitable or not? I said, I would never want to do a business with someone who doesn't know how to make money on me, because in the end, you're going to lose. It doesn't matter. So I want to make sure. And here we are in Asia. A few months ago, with two of my colleagues I took with me in a factory. So this supplier showing us a beautiful showroom, big machine, big plant. And then he showed me a big machine, packing machine. It cost a lot of money, took a lot of space, and to show me how they are modernizing their business. And I said, can I ask you a question? This machine take that much space, cost that much money, but you only have a production for 1 hour a month on that machine. Is it really worth it? And I said, the factory is running at 20% capacity. So I'm sitting here with my two colleagues, him and his vice president and others. I said, I'm sorry, we're not going to be able to do business with you. And he said, why not? I said, you know what? You're running a 20% capacity production. For you to make money, either you have to overcharge me or you lose money. In both area, I'm not comfortable. He couldn't believe that I was able, and my guys with me, they said, how can you tell them that? And I said, I'm telling him for hopefully he learns something out of it. He's trying to sell me. I need to be sure that he's making money, how he could make money when his plant is 5 times more than he need. Okay, so how are you going to make money? He's going to lose money. And if he loses money, what's good for me? I don't want to work with someone who is not happy. I want to be a win-win situation. So to me, those were example that, you know, you want to make sure your suppliers are well taken care of. You want to be sure that your employees are happy. You know, I mean, again, it's a win-win situation. I've been in 37 years in business. My supplier or my retailer, I still have a relationship with them as long the market need both. I never lost an account because of treatment. I pay my bills on time. My method is three words, always, every day. I put in my wall. Quality, integrity, and profitability. They have to be hand on hand. Quality of product, integrity by doing the right thing in business. And in the end of the day, you have to have a profitability. And it's not about making money. Profitability means I did my job, I made a quality product, and now I'm profitable. Because you could make the best product and you lose money, you're going to be out of business. You could have the best integrity and still is not enough. Those three are instrumental in every step of doing business. So you stand behind those three words. I put it on my wall. I put it in my house. Those are the things that I believe they have to be hands on hands. So anyway.
Yeah, I love that. That's very, very great advice that everyone should listen to and apply to themselves and their business. I'm curious, just what's been the proudest moment as the founder of Jack George's?
The proudest moment, as I said, to me, I make sure that every bill paid on time. And those proudness are those three elements, those three words, three exact words, is quality, integrity, and profitability that I have to believe in it every day. And those were my, you know, I had not screwed anybody in business. I've been in business for a long time. I have a reputation in my employees and my suppliers. And I think that to me is my honors. You know, we came from a culture that I made sure that my dad had a proud of my action. You don't want to shame anything to your family as well. So you stand by specific code of ethic, and that's very important to me. So
that's great. And I mean, it's, yeah, and that's very important, right? I think we all want to have a business, or even as an employee, like, you know, a business that you work for that you're proud of, that you can stand behind, right? That you feel, you know, I like what you're, you know, of course, of what you said with the ship and all those things, but also how you.
Yes. Yeah. And I add something to analyzing a business. So I take my product, you know, I come to the shop early. I look at every return, come to the shop, because very important to me, those are things. But one thing I thought of, 70% or 75% of every return come to the shop come from something called a thread. The thread is what holding the bag, stitching. But the cost of a bag is $300 an average bag we make. The cost of that thread is maximum is 30 cents per bag. So imagine you are 1/10 of a 1% the cost of that item, and that item called thread. Do you want to buy cheaper thread? So one day a guy called on me and he said, Jack, you're buying this American fiber thread and I could save you some money. And I said, okay, Walter, tell me. He said, I could save you some money. I said, yeah, is it better? He said, no, but it's as good as what you're buying. I said, you know what? I'm not interested. The whole cost of it is 0.1%. And that's my 75% of my return come to. Do I really want to save money on that little thing? I want to buy the most expensive in the world, the best in the world. I don't care for a second best. And the other question, the leather of the bag is 70% of all material cost of a bag is in the leather. The amount of bag going to be returned because of default in leather is 2%. So imagine that the 75% return costs you 0.1%, and then the 70% only brings you 2% headache. So you want to have to be sure. And I think that really require a person to understand analysis is where is your problem. Work on those problems. Sometime, you know, in any business, small little, you know, gadget could destroy, you know, if you don't take care of it. Dust become a dirt. Removing a dust is easy. To keep it become a dirt, it's a much harder to. So again, repair, those things to me is important. I'm involved in every step of the business. I do come in, you know, I like that. I get involved in repair and return, because to me, it's not about repairing the bag. What went wrong? So you could advise the suppliers what he could change in it. And those are the area I think they respect a guy like me when I'm traveling overseas or not, because I'm not just a buyer. I'm there to help them, you know. And I said, I send my my right-hand man goes to the shop too, and they love to see him. Not because it's criticism, but because they could learn from as well. So anyway.
Yeah, which is great. Looking back at your journey, is there a piece of advice you'd give to your younger self just starting out in the industry?
I mean, work hard, be on time. You know, being on time is very, very important. And in business, I went to Boston one time and my appointment was 8:30 in the morning and I was cutting costs, so I couldn't. I lived in Queens, New York, so it was four and a half hour drive. I left home at 4 o'clock in the morning. Somehow or another was traffic on route, you know, 90 on 128. You're from Massachusetts, right?
Yep.
Is that what he told me?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden I get there and was 5 to 9. I was 25 minutes late. Bernie, this older guy said to me, Jack, you're late. Let's make this appointment at 9 o'clock when I open the door. And I don't blame him as a retailer. I don't see any more salespeople. So here I drove 4.5 hours, right? Luckily, I didn't go just for him. I had to see other customers. But that was the lessons of life I learned, and I cherished that moment. Even though it was negative, even though it made me upset, but I learned something out of it very, very clearly. Was no reason for me to be late, you know. And so it's important to work hard, to be on time. You know, so anyway, that to me is very important.
And it's kind of like honoring your commitment in a way, right? What I feel like you've alluded towards on many, many levels, your commitment to your customer, your commitment to your own personal legacy, naming the business after yourself, right? It's a commitment to yourself alone just to make sure you're upholding a certain level of quality and standards.
Absolutely. And treat people small or big according, you know, you can't differentiate it. And I'll give you an example. In 1988, I went to a leather supply show in Paris, France, called Semaine de Cure. So I'm walking into one of the booths, that person I had worked with before, with my former employees, and in front of the entire staff and customers here in a big show, trade show in Paris. He said, "Jack, you little guy, work with my assistant, Al." Basically what he's saying to me, don't waste my time. You two little guy, work with my assistant, Al. That company, and a few years later, was busted. This guy took a job as sales manager with a new company. Now, I became large company, he became the little guy. And he's calling on me, and I said, you know, how I could do business with you? You know, tell me why. He said, but, you know, we know each other for many years. I said, you know what? Honestly, if I could buy it from somewhere else, I wouldn't buy it from you. Just want you to know that. So my point is, again, treat people the way, you know, does distinguish, this is my small account, this is my large account. Small account today could be large account tomorrow. Large account today could be nowhere tomorrow. So that's, to me, advice for young, you know, coming into the business. Respect the little guy. And in the end of the day, we as a business people is how to make money. Do you buy, you bring all this expensive people into your business so to make you money? Actually, not the reverse. You have to make those little guys, you bring them in and elevate them. So when you cannot do that, you know, anybody could hire the most expensive person to come to work in this company and is doing what? Is your job as an owner, as a new business, is to bring someone on the beginning, from the beginning, and give them and uplift them when they become, enjoy their job. And at the same time, is your responsibility as an owner, as an entrepreneurship, to elevate your employees and make them better instead of just always bring that expensive person to the shop just so you make you feel you have now higher. I think that's important. Those were, to me, you bring any person to the company. And we hire a lot of young people in this company, a lot of internship, and we feel it's important to bring them in. And anyway.
Awesome advice, Jack. I really, really appreciate the value you're giving, the insights that you're giving, and you know, and your overarching just theme of who you are as an individual, I guess, which I appreciate, which is, you know, I hope we would see more often than we do, but unfortunately, you know, it's not.
There's always someone out there. I mean, again, I mean, I was fortunate. I was lucky also. But you know what? I said, I was really very lucky. I think the attitude is very important, honestly. I was touched in this world. I came here alone. I was 18 years old. So I could have been in many troubles if I didn't watch every step. But the truth is, this country was great. It opened up doors for me left and right. But I also felt that if you touch people the right way, they come back at you. You know, I look at people. I mean, a guy came in trying to sell me a product. His son now, actually, yesterday was his 29 years working for me. His dad came to sell me a product, and I look at him, and I said, Carmine, he said, what are you laughing, young man? I said, you remind me with my father. I had not seen my dad for 5 years, and here I see someone calling on me. You remind me of my father. The guy didn't know what to say, and he said, you know what? I'm your adopted dad. God, again, bless his soul. He passed away. Till the day he died, this guy, no family affairs, no things. He always felt I was included. I was no family. We had no same background, nothing to do with one another. So basically, that little touch of that person. So I think those are important, to show your emotion, to be yourself. And to me, honestly, those were opportunity and many steps that the doors open. I don't believe in prejudice. I don't believe in this. I think you do your job right. You've been the right. You don't know what door is going to be open for you. I have a young two daughters. My youngest daughter now, she's the youngest supervisor at age 19 in a gym. That made me feel proud. You know, she said, "Dad, I'm the youngest. They never hired someone to make them a supervisor at age 19. I said, "Well, that's good because you have a good character and they see it and you're responsible enough to, you know," she's still in school. But anyway.
Love it. Work hard. Stay positive.
Live within your mean. That's important.
Live within your means. Yeah, very good advice. Very good advice. Like you said, right? You had enough equity, you know, over the many years of doing business in order to withhold storms, which is very important.
I did lecture in high school here. I am not even college kid. You know, I came in young and I didn't go to school. So here I'm lecturing a high school graduate to what, you know, what are you going to tell them? I didn't go to school to tell them that I'm going to but, you know, so to me, I asked them a question. I said, who's the richer, a guy who make $100,000 and save $10,000 a year, or the guy who make $50,000 and save $10,000? Do you know that? Most people said, well, the $100,000 is more money. I said, not true, because the 100 are 10 out of 100 is only 10%. But 10 out of 50 is 20%. So the one who make 50, he actually have a little bit more cushion than the one who have 100,000. And that's how, you know, that was kind of interesting. Even the teacher said, wow, that's interesting. You know, I said, those are important, you know, to me.
Yeah.
To feel rich is not how much money you make, is how much money you save too.
Very true. Very true.
Anyway. Okay.
Great advice. Well, Jack, I really appreciate the time and really appreciate you.
Thank you so much for listening to Scaling with Samir. Please subscribe and leave us a review. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show and mean a lot to me and my team. We also have snippets of these episodes on YouTube. Scaling with Samir is sponsored by Fetch and Funnel. We've partnered with hundreds of businesses and generated over $500 million for clients using our trademarked Fetch and Funnel method. If you're trying to scale your business, get in touch with us today at fetchfunnel.com. You can also get content that you can learn and apply directly into your business to improve results and scale on our email newsletter. If you are a successful business that is crushing it and would like to be on this program, please visit fetchfunnel.com/podcastguest. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.